Obstruction of Justice investigation to Mueller. He had great things to say about Mueller. And there will be more to come out.
We're going to leave it there. I want to thank you all for your input. Marcy Wheeler of EmptyWheel.net speaking to us from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Mehdi Hassan of Al Jazeera English, a host of the program Upfront, also an Intercept columnist. And thanks so much to Shaina Khadidal of the Center for Constitutional Rights. I'll be speaking Saturday in Chicago, 9:30 McCormick Place for the People's Summit. On Sunday, I'll give the keynote address at the New York City Green Festival, 1 p.m. Javits Convention Center. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is just about 5 o'clock. Coming up is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in Thursday, June 15th at 10 p.m. for another special live remote broadcast from What the Festival at the Wolf Run Ranch. Once again, we'll be showcasing the musical and visual artists at this year's festival with interviews, music, and interactions with the producers and the participants, exploring what makes this such a uniquely immersive and entertaining festival. Again, be sure to tune in on Thursday, June 15th at 10 p.m. for our What the Festival broadcast. More information can be found on the KBOO website under Community Events.
Check it out, baby. If the funk gets too hot for your rump, turn the other cheek, mama.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's no-cause eviction bill is stalled in the state Senate. We talked to Margo Black of Portland Tenants United.
The United States Senate has passed a resolution honoring the victims of last month's knife attack on the Portland light rail.
The House of Representatives has rolled back most of the protections in the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 9th, 2017. I'm Ruben Lawrence.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. The methanol refinery proposed for Kalama, Washington, has received a key air pollution permit. Southwest Clean Air Agency regulators say that it would be a minor source of air pollution, even though the plant would emit 1 million tons of greenhouse gases annually. That is the equivalent to adding a 250,000 extra cars to the roads. The $1.8 billion facility would convert natural gas to methanol to be shipped to China. Once there, the methanol would be used in the manufacture of plastics. The facility is still awaiting a shoreline permit and a federal permit for the Columbia River dock. A related project to build a 3.1-mile gas pipeline to service the methanol plant is undergoing a separate permitting process. Northwest Innovation Works has stated that construction of the plant would employ 1,000 workers. The Chinese-backed company says that once in operation, it will have 200 full-time positions and add millions of dollars to the local tax base. Opponents to the plant point to the dramatic increase in consumption of fracked natural gas and the increase of greenhouse gases that the refinery will generate. They also worry that the plant sits right in the middle of the Cascadia subduction zone, a geologically active area where massive earthquakes can be expected every 200 to 1200 years. The last time that has happened was in January of 1700, when a 9.0 quake dropped the coastline by several feet and generated destructive tsunamis that hit Japan.
A report in this morning's Oregonian says that federal investigators are looking into the failure of the Portland-based Zoom Health Plan, the insurance arm of the well-known chain of Zoom Care medical clinics. According to a statement from the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services, unidentified federal agents arrived at Zoom's downtown offices yesterday morning to interview employees. In early April, Zoom had notified the DCBS of their intention to withdraw from the insurance market in 2018. The agency placed the Zoom health plan under supervision at that time, but a spokesman for the insurer pointed out that they had $9 million available to cover any claims. In late April, Oregon state regulators reported accounting discrepancies in the financial reporting of the Zoom health plan. The agency had been led to believe that Zoom management would be putting another $3 million into the health plan by the end of 2016, but that never happened. These irregularities caused the regulators to place the health plan in receivership under state oversight.
House Bill 2004, the no-cost evictions bill, passed the Oregon House earlier this session, but it's now held up in the Senate. It stalled despite the removal of major provisions that would have allowed cities to chart their own course on rent control. Portland's Tenants United is planning an action tomorrow during a legislative town hall at Centennial High School. The school is located at 3505 Southeast 182nd Avenue in Gresham, and the session runs from 2 to 3:30. KBOO's Ray Bodwell spoke with Margo Black of Portland Tenants United about the problems and the group's efforts to get the bill back on track.
I'm speaking with Margo Black of Portland Tenants United. House Bill 2004, the No-Cause Evictions Act, did pass the Oregon House earlier this year, but has stalled in the Senate. Margo, please tell us what's going on.
Well, the bill passed out of the House, and then it was in the Senate Human Services Committee, and it passed out of that committee with a recommendation to go to the floor. But in order to get the votes, we actually lost a real key part of the bill, which was lifting the ban on rent control, which would allow cities to regulate rent increases to just a fair rate of return for landlords. So we lost that piece in order to try to get the votes of a few Dems who were on the fence, in particular Senator Rod Monroe, who's an East County Democrat and a landlord of a 51-unit apartment complex. And even after we took out the rent control, lifting the rent control preemption, Rod Monroe is still a no. Republicans don't need stable, secure, safe housing. And so we have 17 Dems in the legislature. Betsy Johnson is a hard, don't even talk to me about this, no, which leaves Rod Monroe. You know, he like I said, he's in East County. Most of his constituents are renters. They're low-income renters. They're from marginalized communities. They're already on the second or third wave of displacement out of Portland. They're getting $400, $500, $600 in rent increases. You know, even though we're seeing rents level off a little bit in close in Portland and only on high-end properties, not on older properties, we're still seeing outrageous rent increases and building-wide no-cause evictions happening in East Portland. And Rod Monroe is you know, basically holding tenants across the state hostage, you know, because he's a landlord.
Yeah, I mean, this clearly smacks of conflict of interest, if it nothing does. Else.
Tina Kotek's chief signature piece of legislation this year managed to get it, you know, through the House. Even with the lifting the ban on rent control still in there. Again, that wouldn't impose rent control. It just lets cities, you know, handle that policy on their own. Now, of course, the housing crisis is statewide, but it is experienced differently across the state. It's experienced different in urban places than it is in rural places. And so it makes really good sense for local jurisdictions to have more power to write policy that kind of matches with their, you know, how the crisis is being experienced locally. But we lost that. I mean, we gave that up in the Senate in order to get Rod Monroe's vote. I think that we need to be fighting for the scraps that remain in House Bill 2004. We need to send a message to the legislature that they cannot conclude this session without addressing our housing crisis on the tenants' rights side.
My understanding is you have an action plan and an attempt to break this logjam?
So there's a town hall tomorrow at Centennial High School. So it is a legislative town hall. You can find the Facebook event on our Facebook page, Portland Tenants United or Community Alliance of Tenants. It's at Centennial High School. It is from 2 to 3:30 p.m. tomorrow, Saturday, June 10th.
Margo, thank you so much for your time and good luck with your efforts. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
By a vote of 25-5, the Oregon Senate has approved an $8.2 billion funding bill for public school grades K-12. The bill will move to the House for a vote early next week. The bill is an 11% increase over last year's budget and adds an additional $175 million to school funding. Legislators believe that the increase in funding is sufficient to maintain current service levels, but school administrators say they need more money to avoid teacher layoffs or shorten school days in some districts. The Oregon School Boards Association says that the minimum funding level is $8.4 billion. They say that additional funds are needed for employees and increased contributions to the state's Public Employees Retirement Fund. The Oregon Education Association Teachers Union has targeted $8.6 billion as the minimum funding level and has urged a no vote on the current bill. The union also filed two ballot initiatives for 2018. One is for a hike in corporate taxes that would provide an additional $175 million for school. The second initiative seeks to eliminate the supermajority voting requirement, which would make it easier for the legislature to raise business taxes.
Yesterday, the United States Senate passed a resolution honoring the three victims of the knife attack on the Portland light rail last month. The resolution, which was supported by the entire Oregon congressional delegation, passed the Senate unanimously. Speaking after the vote, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden said, quote, "These three Oregonians stood up courageously against terrorism and for core American values of tolerance and freedom. This resolution properly honors their bravery," end quote. Next, it goes to the U.S. House for its consideration. If approved, it would be sent to the president for his signature.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for a rainy day with isolated thunderstorms and a daytime high of about 60. East of the Cascades and Hood River, early morning rain will give way to a cloudy day with temperatures in the mid-60s. Today in history, on this date in 1898, China agreed to lease Hong Kong to Britain for 99 years. The quote of the day is from American journalist Robert Trout, who said, quote, "The British seizure of Hong Kong was one of the most ugly crimes of the British Empire. The takeover and destruction of India and the use of India to flood China with opium."
The behavior of the various law enforcement agencies at last Sunday's rallies in downtown Portland has come under fire. Several reporters from this station covered the protests, and KBOO's Ray Bodwell has these observations.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler and Police Chief Mike Marshman are receiving much public criticism and more than a few questions around their handling of Sunday's rallies in downtown Portland. Many saw the tactics employed by the Portland police and their colleagues in the Oregon State Police, the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, the Department of Homeland Security, and the FBI as antagonistic from the start and unnecessarily violent at the end. Along with several other volunteer KABU reporters, I arrived at City Hall just before noon on Sunday, and by that time, the battle lines had already been clearly drawn. The Portland Stands United Against Hate rally was beginning to fill the sidewalk in front of City Hall. The Antifa and other folks opposed to the alt-right were gathering in Chapman Park. And the group Portland Labor United Against Hate was occupying the sidewalk on the east side of Southwest 3rd. Caught in the vocal crossfire between these three groups was the Trump Free Speech rally, also referred to as the alt-right rally. They were sequestered in Trunk Plaza, surrounded by DHS agents who were busily circling the block with yellow police tape. And as we watched, a couple of things became immediately apparent. First, the DHS guards surrounding Trunk Plaza were almost all facing out towards the other rallies. Although whether this was to prevent an assault from opposition protesters, or simply because they couldn't stand looking at some of the hateful banners being displayed in Trunk Plaza, was never really clear. Second, there did appear to be some kind of working agreement between the police and the private security that was associated with the Trump alt-right rally. Anyone who questions that has only to watch the video on the Portland Mercury website that shows an apparent Antifa member having a verbal exchange with a Trump Free Speech rallier before being run down and tackled by a group of police and alt-right private security. And as you watch that video, you may find yourself asking, as I did, why the young man felt he had to run in the first place, and why the police and security chased him and tackled him. The final thing that became obvious to us was that the state, local, and city police were clearly expecting trouble, and almost all of them were decked out in full riot gear. It was also very clear that they were expecting that the trouble would come from the Antifa and others that were in Chapman Park. The heaviest contingent of riot gear-equipped police were lined up along Madison Avenue between Trunk Plaza and Chapman Park, and they were virtually all facing Chapman. And at regular intervals during the day, a loudspeaker aimed at Chapman would tell protesters to remain in the park and that the rally would be broken up immediately in the event of, quote, any criminal activity, end quote. But despite obvious antagonism from all three counter-protest groups towards the Trump alt-right rally, there was very little actual trouble until 3:30 when police claimed that a brick or bricks were thrown at them from Chapman Park. Eyewitnesses have disputed this claim, but even if it's true, it was not what you'd call a hail of projectiles. And with all the police that were there, if indeed a brick had been thrown, the police should have been able to identify who threw it and simply arrest that person or persons. But instead, they ordered the protesters to retreat to the center of Chapman Park and began prodding them like so much unruly cattle. When the crowd didn't move fast enough, they unleashed a barrage of tear gas and flashbang grenades and a stream of rubber and pepper bullets at a group of 200 to 300 people, including Antifa and the other anti-Trump protesters, as well as members of the press and curious onlookers. Unfortunately, Sunday's heavy-handed police response is just the latest example of rapid escalation by a police bureau with a long history of hyper-aggressive behavior. And for the citizens of Portland, it's long past time to start holding the city's leadership accountable. Who defines the police strategies? Who approves the tactics? Who makes the decision on the street? And most importantly, how do we get to a point where the police bias is towards de-escalation, not aggression? Now, you may be thinking that Portland Chief Mike Marshman would be the person who should provide these answers. After all, he was in charge of the five different uniformed law enforcement agencies that were involved on Sunday, right? Nope. Marshman was at home during the protests. As police spokesman Sergeant Pete Simpson told the Portland Mercury, quote, procedurally, the chief is not the incident commander at these events, so his attendance is not critical. But we do know that Mayor Wheeler was in the command center on Sunday, so Mr. Mayor, I guess it's up to you to provide some answers. And please be quick about it. Time and patience are running out. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
In this edition of the Civil Liberties Minute, the ACLU's Bill Newman looks at the 45th President's Advisory Committee on Election Integrity.
Donald Trump has appointed the leading voter suppression advocate in America to head what Trump has dubbed his Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. Trump has appointed Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach to head this Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. But as Democratic Representative Jim Ward, the Kansas House Minority Leader, says, whenever I hear Kris Kobach's use of the word voter fraud, what that means in English for regular folks is voter suppression. Indeed, as reported just recently in the New York Times, last year, judges found that Kobach's voter suppression tactics caused, quote, a mass denial of fundamental constitutional rights that prevented 1 in 7 people who had newly registered to vote from casting ballots. 1 in 7! Kobach claims that President Trump would have won the popular vote last year, a vote which he lost by over 3 million, but for the millions and millions of votes cast by illegal voters. There is absolutely no basis for this claim, and he stands by it 100%. As Representative Ward said, quote, most secretaries of state see their job to be a fair arbiter of elections. Kris Kobach believes that the Secretary of State is a partisan tool to affect the results of elections. So, welcome to Donald Trump and Kris Kobach's Alice in Wonderland world of democracy and voting. First the results, then the election. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
On Wednesday, while most of the country was swept up in the testimony of James Comey, the U.S. House of Representatives quietly voted to roll back most of the provisions of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. Voting along party lines, the Republican-controlled House passed the Financial Choice Act. The bill was strongly supported by the Trump administration, who claims that it was necessary to ease banking regulations to spur economic growth. Dodd-Frank was instituted after the economic collapse of 2008. It required banks to regularly submit to stress tests to confirm their financial stability and required them to retain higher cash reserves. Dodd-Frank also created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The Bureau was created to protect Americans from predatory lending practices in the mortgage and credit card industries. Critics of the Financial Choice Act point out that despite Dodd-Frank's strong provisions, the banking industry had a record year for profits in 2016 and Wall Street bonuses rose. They complain that the act would strip the CFPB of most of its authority. The agency used those powers to fine Wells Fargo $100 million last year for opening up to 2 million accounts customers did not ask for or even know about. The Financial Choice Act would also do away with the Volcker Rule, which restricts big banks' ability to make certain risky financial bets. The bill is not likely to pass the Senate in its current form, but that hasn't eased opponents' fears.
Texas Representative Al Green has drafted articles of impeachment against the 45th president. The Houston Democrat went ahead despite having received multiple death threats. Green has maintained that Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey constituted a clear-cut case of obstruction of justice. In a statement on Tuesday, Green said, quote, "The facts are simple and indisputable. The president fired the FBI director because the director was investigating the president's campaign connections to Russian interference in the presidential election," end quote. Green began the process after hearing Comey's testimony on Thursday in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Democratic Party leaders have until this point resisted calls for Trump's impeachment. But on Thursday night, Democratic National Committee Chairman Tom Perez tweeted that, quote, "Trump knew exactly what he was doing. It's called obstruction of justice," end quote.
And now, with this edition of Climate Connection, here's Anthony Lizowitz. In this episode, he looks at the impact of hot weather on aggressive behavior.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Professional baseball pitchers can throw more than 100 miles per hour, so when a batter gets hit by a pitch, it hurts. It's often not clear if the hit is intentional, but
there's a kind of long-standing tradition in baseball that if you hit one of my guys, we need to retaliate and hit one of your guys.
That's Rick Larrick of Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. He studies decision-making and says hot weather has been linked to more aggressive behavior. He studied baseball statistics and found that pitchers are slightly more likely to retaliate when it's hot. He speculates it's because people are already on edge.
Once you are uncomfortable and irritable, you are just more easily agitated, and the same kind of insult or offense seems bigger.
As the climate warms, he says we should keep in mind how extreme heat may influence our perceptions of everyday behavior, too. Like when someone bumps into you outside a bar on a hot night.
If we are concerned that temperatures will be going up on average, it just makes it possible for there to be more of these opportunities for otherwise meaningless provocations becoming meaningful provocations.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. The People's Summit convenes in Chicago this weekend. Senator Bernie Sanders is headlining the event, billed as Beyond Resistance, a people's movement for a just world. The People's Summit says, quote, at a time of tremendous turmoil and progressive opportunity, we invite you to participate in a historic convening of organizations and individuals committed to social, racial, and economic justice, end quote. The gathering is an effort to bring together progressive activists, including some labor unions, to create a people's agenda that can enhance and expand issue campaigns and hold all elected officials accountable to popular demands for justice, equality, and freedom. National Nurses United and the United Electrical Workers are the only labor unions listed as convening partners. The Chicago Teachers Union, for example, is not on the list. Neither is the AFL-CIO. Other labor groups, though, that are participating include Our Walmart, Good Jobs Nation, and United Students Against Sweatshops. Los Angeles public school educators, students, and community activists held an education, not deportation, rally and press conference Thursday for Claudia Rueda. She's a Roosevelt High School graduate and college student seized May 18th by Border Patrol agents outside her family home. She was taken into custody and put in detention in San Diego. The rally demanded her release. United Teachers of Los Angeles is joining the call for her release and also for an end to ICE deportation raids. The teachers' union says a good education, quote, is not possible with immigration enforcement in our neighborhoods, end quote. The teachers' union also supports calls for the Los Angeles sheriff and LA officials to stop cooperating with ICE in Los Angeles County. Claudia is an undocumented immigrant rights activist. Her supporters believe she was picked up in retaliation for speaking out in support of her mother. Her mother was arrested in April on drug charges that authorities later admitted were baseless. New York City is divesting pension funds from private prison and immigrant detention companies. Make the Road New York, an immigrant advocacy group, says its corporate Backers of Hate campaign highlighted pension investments in private prison companies, identifying those investments as an injustice. Private prison corporations like Core Civic and Geo Group will no longer benefit from New York City pensions investments. J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo banks help finance private prison companies. Make the Road New York says divesting pension funds from private prison and immigrant detention companies sends a strong message that, quote, our communities won't support corporations that are locking up members of our communities.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio, live nationwide weekdays noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Celos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Ruben Lawrence. Coming up on Monday, June 12th, at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time and goes where corporate media fears to tread. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein. At 11, Health Watch speaks to Dr. Samantha Brody about her book, Overcoming Overwhelm. And at 11:30, Remembering Stonewall, the 1989 documentary that preserves the voices of the participants, from Deputy Inspector Seymour Pine, who marshaled the raid, to Sylvia Rivera, one of the drag queens who battled that historic night. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, quote, she took the family to McDonald's because they liked it, even though she knew they couldn't afford to eat out. She went through more pain pills than she needed, and every few weeks, when those pills ran low, like today, she returned to the doctor for more. Close quote. That's some of what the Washington Post thinks you should know about the mother in a family that relies on Social Security disability insurance. The paper is doing a series on disability benefits, and so far it's exactly like that fragment suggests. And if you